And welcome, listeners. Welcome to WPFW Washington. This is the hour of We the People. I'm your host, David Whetstone, right here at 89.3 FM, WPFWFM.org, and later on through various social media platforms. We're a Jazz and Justice radio station in existence for 48 years because listeners like you choose to support your Jazz and Justice station. We seek to build a better world, one broadcast at a time. And with your help and my thanks, we do that together. This morning, we're going to focus on the Joy Goddess. Joy Goddess Aaliyah Walker in the Harlem Renaissance. Miss Walker was a woman of means, inspiration, and action who made profound impact upon the arts and culture of the Harlem Renaissance, the Jazz Age, America, and beyond. In order to understand that undertaking by this powerful historical figure, we have Aaliyah Bundles. She is the author of Joy Goddess, Aaliyah Walker and the Harlem Renaissance, the first major biography of her great-grandmother, and she's also the author of On Her Own Ground, The Life and Times of Madam C.J. Walker, a biography about her great-great-grandmother and early 20th century hair industry entrepreneur and philanthropist. Ms. Bundles is the founder of the Madam Walker Family Archives, the largest private collection of Walker photographs, memorabilia, and ephemera, and she worked in network television news for 30 years, first at NBC News, where she was a producer for news and magazine programs, then at ABC News, where she was a World News Tonight producer. Ms. Bundles was also ABC News Washington, D.C. Deputy Bureau Chief and Director of Talent Development. She's also the former Vice Chair of the Columbia University Board of Trustees and the former Board Chair of the National Archive Foundation. She's a member of several boards that reflect her interest in history, journalism, political activism, social justice, the arts, and historical preservation. Thank you, Ms. Bundles, for being here. It's a pleasure to have you.
David Whetstone, thank you very much for having me. Love your program.
Well, thank you. Well, let's get right into it because there's a lot of ground to cover. And for those who are not entirely familiar with Madam C.J. Walker, can you share with us a little bit about her life? And I'm interested particularly in listeners getting to know how it pertains to the shaping and formation of Aaliyah Walker.
Absolutely. So as you said, my book, On Her Own Ground, The Life and Times of Madam C.J. Walker, was the first major biography of Madam Walker. I wrote that and it came out in 2001, which was a while ago. And I think it has reshaped how people see her. So what people know about Madam Walker is that she developed hair care products. So that's kind of the headline. But in writing and researching that book, I discovered this about her. Born Sarah Breedlove, 1867, Delta, Louisiana, same plantation where her parents and older siblings had been enslaved. First child in her family born free. A washerwoman until she was 38 years old. But by the time she died in 1919, she was living in one of the wealthiest communities in America. She was a millionaire, but more importantly to me, she had trained thousands of Walker sales agents who sold her products, helped them become economically independent, and she also encouraged them to be politically involved.
Well, along with that, I'd just like to add and beg out that it wasn't just a matter of having a sales force. She really affirmed their communities, their life purposes, their freedom, their agency. And, you know, it's not that many decades after the Civil War and the Emancipation. And so she plays a critical role in American history.
Absolutely. It's a half century. So you could say two generations of people after the Civil War, after emancipation. And she is somebody who experienced that. Her own family had been enslaved, and she was, as a Black woman, certainly discriminated against, had very little education. And so she wanted to provide these opportunities for the women who were her sales agents. And she had been inspired by the women of St. Paul African Methodist Episcopal Church. When her first husband died, she moved from Louisiana to St. Louis, where her older brothers were barbers. And it was those women who gave her a vision of herself as something other than an illiterate washerwoman. So she understood the power of community.
And let's get to the immediate subject, her daughter. What is it that intrigued you about your great-grandmother?
You know, even though I've now written four books about Madam C.J. Walker, and Madam Walker obviously is the more famous, you know, perhaps the more historically consequential person, it was really Alelia Walker who intrigued me first. We share a name, you know, so there's that. But when I was in high school in 1970, my senior year in high school, I had to write a report for a Black humanities class. There's a whole nother story behind how that happened, but I was in a predominantly white school. But my report was about Alelia Walker and the Harlem Renaissance. So I was writing about her more than 50 years ago. And I'm pretty sure at this point that my mother made me aware that we had these materials at home. So I had the original invitation and menu to Alelia Walker's cultural salon, The Dark Tower. We had books in our house like Conte Cullen's Color, Langston Hughes's The Weary Blues, Jean Toomer's Cain. And I was just discovering Black writers. I loved to write and I identified with that. And the fact that this person who I had never met, but who was my great grandmother, had known these people made me intrigued about her. So now we're many, many years later, and finally have finished this biography about her.
So we just talked about Madam C.J. Walker's journeying with daughter from the Mississippi Delta to St. Louis. What were some of the struggles that they faced together? What were some of the things that were formative for their relationship?
So it's so important, you know, when you think of that she was born on a plantation. She was orphaned at seven, Madam Walker, orphaned at seven, married at 14, she said, to get a home of her own, to get away from her sister and her, what she called her cruel brother-in-law. Her first husband, Moses McWilliams, she married at 14. They had one child, Lelia, when she was 17, and he died when she was 20. She then moved up the river to St. Louis. So that was her early life. Her daughter is growing up as what was considered a half orphan, and they were struggling. She was working as a washerwoman, but she, like most parents, worked hard because she wanted her daughter's life to be better. But those early decades in both of their lives of struggle informed how they experienced their wealth, informed their goals and their intentions as they developed their business. But it was a very close, but also very complicated mother-daughter relationship.
Yes, indeed. Anytime there's struggle, that's going to happen, of course. We've referenced or alluded time and time again that even though they were, how can I put it, feisty, self-determined women, they had the aid and the support of the community. What was the community of St. Louis like? Particularly as we're going to dive into how Alelia supported the arts and aesthetics and just a whole spread of activity for Black life.
I'm so glad that you are focusing on community. David, not a lot of people, you know, make that focus. And so I'm really glad to have the opportunity to talk about that. So you just imagine this 20-something-year-old woman is moving to a city. She's been living in rural Louisiana and Mississippi. She moves to a city. It's overwhelming. Because her brothers are barbers at a time when Black men dominated the barbering trade, and they were the largest group, barbers were the largest group of entrepreneurs, Black entrepreneurs in St. Louis. So she was coming into a situation where her brothers had some, you know, notoriety, but still not wealthy by any means. But it was that church. It was the AME church, the women of the church. Sarah Breedlove, the washerwoman, had a good enough voice to be in the choir. So she was surrounded by music and surrounded by other people. She was a member of the MITE, M-I-T-E, MITE Missionary Society. She's, MITE is the widow's mite. And so she is being embraced by these women. And that was very formative for her. One woman in particular, Jessie Batts Robinson, who was a school teacher, but who also was an officer, a national officer in the Women's Auxiliary of the Black Knights of Pythias. And even though she was close in age to Sarah Breedlove, she mentored her, she exposed her. And that was very important. The National Association of Colored Women, the national organization of Black women that was formed in the 1890s when white women excluded Black women from the suffrage organizations, they met in her church. They met in Sarah Breedlove's church in 1904 during the World's Fair. So she saw these examples along with the examples of the AME church itself.
And I'm glad you're emphasizing Black awareness of what's going on in the world, whether it's their immediate neighborhood or community, but beyond. There's this dampening in our mainstream history and not really appreciating that. So I appreciate it, and I'm sure our listeners do too.
Yeah, Black history is every day.
Yes, it's for everybody. It's for us,
but it's for everybody. It is American history.
One thing I don't want to let slip by, being in St. Louis and in their particular neighborhood, they were exposed to Scott Joplin and some of the great musicians of the time. Do you want to say more about that?
Yes, David, thank you. You read the book closely and I love it. So yes, Scott, so when you think about that neighborhood, so ragtime is being born in St. Louis in the 1890s. They have moved to St. Louis in about 1888 or so. They're right in the midst of the Black neighborhood. So from the music scene, just to put it in context, there, the choir director at St. Paul AME Church, who also was the organist, was a classically trained tenor. So they were exposed to spirituals. They were exposed to opera. The music department for the public schools in St. Louis were run by German musicians. And so the Black children in the segregated schools were learning German Lieder that they performed in their spring programs. Several of the principals at the colored schools had been trained at Oberlin. So they had a musical background. And then, so that's the formal music. On the street and in the dance halls, people were doing cakewalks. And for a little while, Sarah Breedlove and her daughter Lelia lived across the alley from Tom Turpin's Rosebud Cafe, which is where Scott Joplin performed. So they, in the middle of the night, little Lelia was waking up hearing Scott Joplin on the piano.
Allow me to reintroduce you. We're talking about the joy goddess, Lelia Walker. The period that she was active in was the Harlem Renaissance, and our guest is indeed her great-granddaughter, Lelia Bundles. Ms. Bundles is, I don't want to embarrass you, but you're a cultural impactor, influencer, icon in your own right.
Thank you.
And I thank you for your work and your being with us this morning. Didn't want to do the early bridge, but I'm going to do it. I don't know if listeners caught that we, more so you, have referred to Lelia, as opposed to Lelia. Is it time to reveal the mystery?
Absolutely.
Of how the comes into being?
So, Lelia Walker, who Langston Hughes called the joy goddess of Harlem's 1920s because of her great parties and her big personality, hence the title of the book, Joy Goddess. Her birth name was Lelia McWilliams. Her father was Moses McWilliams. And she had that name into the 1920s. But after a trip that took her to London, Paris, Rome, Addis Ababa, Cairo, Palestine, a year or so after she came back, as she was going through a divorce, she added the A apostrophe. Now, that's been my name since, you know, since I was born in 1952. And of course, it is a mystery to me about exactly why she added the A apostrophe. I only can provide the context for what she was going through in her life, but the A apostrophe appeared in 1922. And I said there are a couple of reasons that I, you know, surmise. There was another Black woman who was also a prominent woman married to the president of a Black insurance company. Her name was Lelia Walker. And while they weren't exactly, she was in Memphis or Nashville, while they weren't exactly in the same circles, that was enough to not want to have your name be the same. But also, some of the other women who were friends of hers, Romery Bearden's mother, Bessie Bearden, changed the spelling of her name from Bessie to Bessye. Another good friend, Mary Washington White, Mary White, changed her name to Mamie, Maymie. So some of it may just be affectation, but I just know the grand Alelia is the name that I have.
And a small point, you mentioned Bessie Bearden, who was an actress who participated with Oscar Micheaux Productions, by the way.
Yeah, little known fact about Bessie Bearden because she's Romery Bearden, the famous artist, his mother. But she had many dimensions to her
Yes.
life. She was in Atlantic City at Fitzgerald's Hall. She was the cashier. Then later, she was on the New York School Board. She was the society columnist. So, yes, she was quite a talented person.
Yeah, and thank you for unfolding that. I'm smiling with great pleasure hearing you say that. If we could switch gears for a moment, the sense of travel across the country and being in different places, that's critical for both mother and daughter. And I don't know where we should start. I know there was a short stint in Denver, but they wound up in Indianapolis, and I'm particularly interested, again, in this theme of community, their impact on that city, and for that matter, we can expand to Black communities all over the United States in their time.
Yeah, so Madam Walker started in South Louisiana, lived in St. Louis, moved to Denver in 1905. And at that point, she was actually selling products that were made by Annie Malone, who later became her competitor. But
And her
in
brothers were
Denver,
there, am I right?
I'm sorry.
Were her brothers there?
Her brothers were in St. Louis, but
Oh, okay.
she moved to Denver. Her brothers had died by this point in
Oh, I'm sorry.
1905. But she moved to Denver because she had a sister-in-law, a widowed sister-in-law who was there, and she had her nieces, and they could help her with the business. Her good friend, Charles Joseph Walker, moved from St. Louis to Denver in late 1905. They married in early 1906. And she was working as a cook for a pharmacist. So she was beginning to mix up her own formulas with the help of the pharmacist. She married Charles Joseph Walker and began putting ads in the Black newspaper there, Madam C.J. Walker. So that was the beginning of the company. Then they traveled. She moved to Pittsburgh, settled in Pittsburgh. Her daughter joined her in Pittsburgh. And then she and Charles Joseph Walker moved to Indianapolis in 1910 while her daughter was still running the Pittsburgh office and taking care of the East Coast outposts.
And why in Indianapolis?
So Indianapolis, where I grew up, you know, people think sometimes I have people say, are there Black people in Indianapolis? But yes, there are a lot of Black people in Indianapolis. It was called the Crossroads of America because of the trains that ran through the city every day, the early highways. And so if you had a mail order business, it was a great location. So the Pullman porters who came through would pick up the Black newspaper where she advertised. They would sell it all over the country. People would see her ads. So that was important. But it also had a very thriving Black business community. Three Black newspapers, a number of businesses, and a really strong chapter of the National Negro Business League. So she found the Indianapolis as a really good place to do business.
And Madam Walker, just want to acknowledge, was heavily involved in the Business League, if I'm not mistaken.
She was. So Madam Walker was, she, you know, she admired what Booker T. Washington had been able to create with Tuskegee, with the National Negro Business League. She didn't always agree with his politics. She ultimately was spied upon by the War Department because she was considered a Negro subversive. So she was more radical politically. But he had built institutions, and she admired that about him. So she attended the conventions, like 1910 was her first convention, but she was still, you know, people were still discovering who she was. But by 1912, she had established her business, and she attended one of his conventions. She'd already given $1,000 to the building fund of the Black YMCA in Indianapolis, and she wanted to speak at the convention. And Booker T. Washington was, you know, he was controlling what was going on at his conventions. And you, if anybody who's planned a convention knows, you have your speakers lined up, you know, months in advance. But she wanted to speak. And when he wouldn't give her permission, she took permission and wow. stood up at the end of the convention and said, "Surely you're not going to shut the door in my face." And then she went on to make a speech, and eventually there was a mutual respect between the two.
Yeah, I just to add to that, I don't want to understate or allow the moment to understate her sphere of influence. An associate of Mr. Washington's, is it Emmett Scott? I know
Emmett
it's
Scott.
Mr. Yeah, was had a position in the administration in the Department of Defense, if I'm not mistaken.
Right.
But then you, on the other hand, you have A. Philip Randolph and all these other people in between. And that's why your earlier comment that she was considered, she was surveilled and considered dangerous is really much in effect.
Yeah, you know, dangerous Negro is, you know, is the label that I like. But, you know, interestingly for me, I mean, we know the kind of the cliche of the W.E.B. Du Bois, Booker T. Washington, which camp are you in? And we know that sometimes those lines crossed. But what I find interesting about Madam Walker is that, you know, people did feel like there were some people in high places who felt that they had to make a choice between the two, because Booker T. Washington controlled the purse strings on things, but other people were frustrated by the slow, you know, no progress. But because Madam Walker had her own economic base, she did not have to be loyal to one position or another. So her friends included Booker T. Washington and Emmett Scott, but also Monroe Trotter, also A. Philip Randolph.
Yes.
Also W.E.B. Du Bois. So I love that about her, that she would have said, whatever I can do to help the race.
That's an important theme. I'm so glad you mentioned that. And it conveys and is carried forth by her daughter as well. We're coming up on a break, but I wanted to see if I could squeeze in something else. The sense of somehow having this perfect blend of personal ambition and aspiration, but at the same time having a belongingness to community, and in this case, not being overly dramatic, the fate of the race. That's going to carry forth maybe in a different way with daughter Alilia, of course. But in the meantime, not to undermine that, there's some more of the personal aspects that we need to understand. Maybe you could take a few minutes and just talk about this personal dynamic between the two of them. A lot's happening as we can gather.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Yeah, so, you know, you think about having a parent who is larger than life, who is, as many people believe, the first self-made American woman millionaire. Now, there are other Black women who could fit that bill, but they're just, we have documentation. And some of the other names that we might know, like Biddy Mason or Mary Ellen Pleasance, there's not the same level of documentation. So I just kind of say, I let other people have that argument. But to know that a mother is known, not just nationally, but internationally, that she's providing a livelihood for thousands of Black women, she's transforming lives, she's involved politically. That's a big act to follow. And Alilia has her own big personality. She has her own interests. Both women are interested in culture. And I think it's you just can't, duplicate Madam Walker, and Alelia Walker, trying to find her own way, leans into culture. But there were conflicts between mother and daughter. Madam Walker certainly spoiled her daughter, would have done anything for her. But there were things that they disagreed about. A couple of Alelia Walker's husbands, they were not on board. They were not in agreement on that. How Alelia ran the business. Sometimes Madam Walker interfered. The founder of a company has certain ways that they
Yes,
want
founder
things to be
syndrome.
done.
My goodness. Also, let's not neglect, in a very visible sense, they were women of stature. Alelia Walker was quite a comely woman, tall, dark skin, and her comportment and raiment is something to be noted. I wonder if you want
Yeah,
to put some
I this
substance
is
in
the
that.
what I she took on a large she took on a larger than life persona for some people. She was probably about 5'9", though sometimes you see her described as over 6 feet tall because, as someone said, she didn't just walk into a room, she swept into a room. She wore turbans, and so she was quite elegant. Her clothes were designed often by black designers. My grandfather, who was her son-in-law, described her as royal with royal instincts. Another person said she attracted people like bees to flowers. So there was a charisma about her.
Well, you know what? I think we're going to go into our break, but I want to say a few things. I want to remind listeners that they're listening to We the People. I'm your host, David Whetstone. But importantly, you're listening to WPFW 89.3 FM, WPFWFM.org. We're known as the Jazz and Justice Radio Station. We've been in existence for 48 years because many of you listeners, new and seasoned, choose to support us with both financial wherewithal and also social connectivity. And for that, I am grateful, and I join 100 other programmers and staff in saying thank you. We'll be back with Alelia Bundles talking about her great grandmother, Alelia Walker, and we're going to move through history and time focusing on this historic figure. We'll find out more. If you stay with us and come back.
WPFW presents Genius plus Soul equals Ray and John. Tuesday, September 23rd, 5 a.m. until midnight. This will be a fundraising birthday tribute like no other, illuminating the lives and contributions of Ray Charles and John Coltrane, two icons of American music. Schedule and details at WPFWFM.org, where you can also contribute anytime. WPFW, preserving the culture, one broadcast at a time.
Lipstick and threw on a shirt.
Well, we're back. You're listening to We the People. I'm your host, David Whetstone, right here at WPFW 89.3 FM. My pause also betrayed a thought, and that was, like your ancestors, you're a traveling woman. You're all over the place. And I always want to remind listeners that as much as we try to do in an hour, there are always other opportunities to do a deep dive into our subjects. What are you doing with not only this book project, but your wonderful great-grandmother?
So, David, I am. Someone asked me the other day, they're like, is your book tour over? And I'm like, I'm going to be on book tour for the rest of my life because
I think
this is
so.
the fun part of being able to talk with people and tell the story. So, like this Sunday in DC, I'm going to be at the auto shop in Union Market at 416 Moore Street, Northeast. Doing something that's part of the March On Festival. We're doing a Dark Tower inspired brunch, trying to recreate the atmosphere of Alelia Walker's Harlem Renaissance. So it's everything from an acrobatic aerialist to poetry readings to a DJ who is doing the history of Black music. So that's, you know, that's DC this Sunday from 1 to 3. And on my Instagram page, my Facebook, my LinkedIn, all of those things, at Alelia Bundles, you can find my schedule. I have it pinned to the top of each of those feeds. And then my website, AleliaBundles.com and MadamCJWalker.com.
I want to give a rationale why this is critical. You're a thoroughgoing, forgive me, don't chase me, veteran, practiced, seasoned journalist.
You know what? I love every gray hair on my head, so it's okay.
And the wonderful thing you're sharing with us is this privilege that your family choose to, this is not going to do justice, but preserve artifacts mm-hmm. and memories and things of physicality. One thing I can't do in the radio is like describe Madam C.J. Walker's little tin of wonderful hair growth. 2 ounces for 50 cents, which seems pricey at the time, but it's a historical reference that I wanted to make. And importantly, you see this figure of long flowing hair. And for me, as my duty is to be a host here, is not just marveling over aesthetics. That's all well and good. But these things are living history that even wonderfully chase after us, that stay with us. So I just wanted to overemphasize the fact that you value like the primary sources in interviewing and research. And we can get to that some more before we leave the show. But
absolutely. I love talking about my research, so happy to do that.
Okay, great. Well, speaking of which, I've been alluding constantly, and I'm not sure what the proper progression is, but there are two things I wanted to cover with some immediacy after the break. Who was your grandmother? And again, thank you for talking about how these legacies kind of chain relate to you, but are important to all of us. And then we want to finally wind up in New York with Alelia.
Absolutely. So just because the family tree can be a little complicated for folks, Madam C.J. Walker, Sarah, whose name was Sarah Breedlove, had one daughter, Alelia Walker, known later as Alelia Walker. Alelia Walker was married 3 times, but had no biological children. She legally adopted my grandmother, whose name was May, and they had known May's uncle in St. Louis at St. Paul AME Church. And when Madam Walker moved to Indianapolis, May's grandmother lived across the street, and they realized that they had this connection from the friendship in St. Louis. And as many people did and still do, there are informal adoptions within our community and formal adoptions. And May was someone who had very long hair, and Madam Walker's main product was Madam Walker's wonderful hair grower. So she served as a model for Madam Walker to demonstrate the products. And then eventually they began to talk with her mother, who was still living, about adoption. Her mother, whose name was Sarah Etta, was the third generation of women in her family to be widowed in her 30s with 7 or 8 children. And while that was a difficult decision, they promised that May would maintain connections with her biological family, that she would be involved in the business, and that she would also get an education. She was an honor roll student, but hadn't been able to continue school. And she eventually went to Spelman, where she graduated with honor. So that was my grandmother, May, who became known as May Walker. And then my mother's name was Alelia May Perry, and I am Alelia Perry Bundle. So these names continue. There are 3 Alelias in my family. You. There are other Alelias, but there are 3 in my family.
Thank you for sharing that so much. So let me fulfill the other half of the promise here. And if I've left something out, please correct, forgive me, or just go ahead and have at it and add in. How in the world did they wind up in New York? I know Alelia had to really convince her mother to do this.
Right.
But tell us that story, if you please.
So, yeah, New York is, you know, Harlem in, was becoming the Black Mecca of culture and politics. Madam Walker had settled in Indianapolis in 1910. Aaliyah was running the Pittsburgh office, but New York was part of her territory. They had visited New York together. Madam Walker had been there. They knew the, she knew the potential. But as Aaliyah was beginning to see that the sales in New York were greater than the sales in Pittsburgh, she persuaded her mother that they needed to have a presence. Now, I think a big part of it was that Harlem was much more interesting to her than Pittsburgh. And so Madam Walker, you know, embraced the idea of buying a building on 136th Street that then later became, they bought the building next door. It later became this beautiful, gorgeous building with a new facade that was designed by Vertner Tandy, who was one of the first licensed Black architects in New York. And also for those folks who are members of Alpha Phi Alpha, they will remember, they will know him as one of the original jewels. But it was, you know, Harlem 1913, when she bought that property, was really becoming what we would eventually come to know as this Mecca.
And maybe a little bit of context. Black folk represented almost a single-digit percentage of the city, but by the 1910s, going into the 20s, there were about 175,000 Black folk concentrated in the area we know as Harlem.
Right. So yeah, there was a big transformation, and part of, you know, that was part of the great migration. We think of Great Migration World War II, but this is World War I. People are moving to cities. And Harlem was unique in that there was new housing, housing that had been built at the turn of the century. It had been a bit overbuilt, where in other cities, most of the places that Black people were moving were really rundown housing, tenements. But this was an opportunity for people to be in new housing, and that was a big attraction.
And to be frank with you, there was a lot of Black displacement out of Central Park, out of Black neighborhoods that were firmly established in downtown Brooklyn and elsewhere in New York.
And yes, in Midtown, the Tenderloin, the area that yes. we know now as Lincoln Center, people were pushed out of those areas, pushed out of the area around Penn Station because they were building the train station. So we've seen that removal before and now.
You know, it's bittersweet and sad, but there's a lot of recurrence of history in this period that we're now landing in, almost recreates some of the dynamics that we're facing today. World conflict, Black folk were keenly aware of it. I'm going to let you fill in the gaps here, but for all sorts of different reasons and motives, Black men were looked upon as honorable in their service during World War I. Part of that, I don't want to vulgarize it, but it was an element of adding to the stature of Black male individuals. Often, besides being a doctor or a dentist or a businessman, if they were a veteran, at least within the Black community, it was considered an honorable role and an added value, so to speak. There's the arrival of what some historians call the Nader, particularly for Black folk, acts of violence, and the continuous of basically editorial, scientific, and artistic denigration of Black folk. All that's going on while these two women are achieving outstanding, by any measure, outstanding effect. There are two things here. What goes on in particular for Harlem is just do a deeper dive for Aaliyah. But also, this is also the period where not only has she recognized the New York market, but mother and the second in command, should I say, Mr. Ransom,
right.
Figured that Aaliyah could do some traveling, and she traveled. Indeed, she did. So I'm really offering you two forks here to pick up on.
Mm-hmm. So when you mentioned the Nadir and what was going on with Black folks, you know, you just if we just like a 30 second Black history lesson, Civil War, the 13th, 14th, and 15th Amendments opened things up. Black people were elected to Congress. Black people had political power. And then the Black codes happened that squashed that voting rights. And then Plessy versus Ferguson in, I think, 1892 said separate but equal. So that progress that had been made for a couple of decades was squashed. But still, that's when organizations like the NAACP were being formed, the National Association of Colored Women. Black folks realized that they have to create their own institutions to survive. And they're always trying to be accepted by America. And so when World War I came along, people volunteered because there were a number of Black leaders who said, if we show our patriotism, if we show our loyalty, if we go to France, if we fight valiantly, we will be celebrated, we will be welcomed, we will be accepted. And yet when the soldiers came back from France in early 1919, it was followed by the Red Summer, when there were riots and massacres and lynchings. And the Wilson administration had jobs that had been available to Black men, especially patronage jobs. All of a sudden, those jobs were no longer available. So there was always this tension. People were going to achieve, they were going to survive, create businesses, create culture, create music, despite what was going on. But there was the pushback. And this is Madam Walker is becoming a businesswoman and really focused on Black women as her customers and as the leadership in her company, along with Mr. Ransom, who's very key. But she's developing this despite what's going on, despite the discrimination and the racism and the laws that are trying to prevent Black people from being accepted as full citizens.
And she and daughter live boldly despite intimidation and disrespect. That's such an important point. Mm-hmm. And it's not going too far when you say that's representative and offered up to the rest of the community, to the rest of the race. That's no exaggeration. Let me further the defense here also. Madam Walker and Alelia were very mindful that there had to be pragmatics. So they supported the NAACP. They supported orphanages. They supported issues of hunger and survival and such. I'm compressing it, but I'm trying to get the rough idea across. Let me do this. Let me reintroduce you. We're talking to Alelia Bundles. Ms. Bundles is the author of Joy Goddess, Alelia Walker and the Harlem Renaissance, which is the subject of our conversation here on We the People. And in her own right, she's been in the world of journalism and philanthropy for quite some time, and I thank her for being with us. This is a good point to also remind you of the many offerings that WPFW 89.3 FM, being the Jazz and Justice station, extend to you. There's at 3 to 5, Sophie's Parlor, the oldest women collective on public broadcasting. They offer music and culture by women, but for everyone. 2 o'clock, Zen El Amin on Shewanana covers Middle Eastern affairs. My good colleague, Moisa Mutali, and producer James Pope offer on Africa Now history, stories, narrative, politics, and culture of African descended people, not only on the continent, but throughout the diaspora. And we would be mindful not to neglect, not to forget the blues. It comes to you every noontime hour during the week. The Wednesday edition is handled by the Clarence the Blues Man Turner. All these programs seek to build better communities in a better world, one broadcast at a time. You have my thanks, listeners, for supporting this station, along with our staff and 100 programmers. Ms. Bundles, again, so much to cover, and we're talking about New York and the dynamics and this big townhouse. The basement is a beauty school. Mm-hmm. The first floor is a salon. I wish radio could somehow convey the physical beauty of that building and that salon. Then things happen on the upper floors. It's on the third floor, there's something known as the Dark Tower. And we mentioned also the importance of architecture. You know, before we get to the Dark Tower, I caught myself. There's one place we should not neglect, not far from New York City, in Irvington, and that is the Villa Leopoldo.
Mm-hmm.
And why don't we tell the story of that before we get to the Dark Tower?
So after Amelia Walker moved to Harlem in 1913, Madam Walker was still living in Indianapolis where the business was headquartered, the Madam C.J. Walker Manufacturing Company. And her health was starting to fail. She had hypertension, but Amelia was really concerned about her. And she was still functioning, but Amelia persuaded her to move her personal residence to New York, to Harlem in 1916. Madam Walker's still traveling, but this beautiful townhouse, which, and people can see the pictures of the townhouse in Joy Goddess and in On Her Own Ground. But this was a beautiful, huge place. But Madam Walker said to her attorney in a letter, this house is not big enough for two women. So they both needed their own space. And she hired the same architect, Vertner Tandy, to design a mansion for her in Irvington, New York. It's still standing. It's a National Historic Landmark. And it was named Villa Lewaro, Lewaro, by Enrico Caruso, the famous Italian operatic tenor, who was a friend of Amelia's. And he visited the house when it was under construction and said that it reminded him of homes in Italy where he had grown up. And so he took the letters from Lelia Walker Robinson to come up with Lewaro.
Fantastic. And you mentioned that it's still it's registered as a National Historical Preservation Site.
Right.
And so is the Walker Building in Indianapolis, too.
That's right. So the Madam Walker, what's now called the Madam Walker Legacy Center, was built in 1927. Madam Walker had started acquiring parcels of land before she died in 1919. But Mr. Ransom, F.B. Ransom, her attorney, and who was called general manager, but now he'd be the CTO, CFO, CIO, all of those things. He really ran the day-to-day operation. He was able to execute her vision for what is now a four-story flat iron-shaped building that had a theater, still has a beautiful theater with an African Moorish motif. The headquarters of the company, the manufacturing space was there. Now it's a cultural center, a social center, as well as one floor of the building is the Africana Studies Department of Indiana University, Indianapolis campus.
Okay. Well, we have to do this. We have to do some compressants. And I want to get back to your namesake. She knew just about everybody. We mentioned a number of people, but Wallace Thurman, County Cullen, the Du Bois family, and I'm going to mention Carl Van Vechten as well.
Right, Carl Van Vechten, yep.
And so here we have this concept of the Dark Tower, the upper floor of the townhouse in Harlem. Tell us what went in the Dark Tower. Why this is such an important moment in American literary history.
Absolutely. So when Amelia Walker built this town, you know, this townhouse in 1913, remodeled in 1915, she began to have events there. She hosted dinner parties, always with live music and great food and interesting people. In the early 20s, she started renting out a floor called as the Walker Studio, where people would have receptions, wedding receptions, sorority and fraternity events, dances, etc. But small kind of intimate things. And then as we began to see in 1924 and 25, Black writers were being celebrated at the opportunity dinner and their books were being published. She was had always been interested in some of these young writers, and she met with Wally Thurman, Conte Cullen, Langston Hughes, Bruce Nugent, and a few others to say, what can we do? What kind of space can we create? And they came up with the idea for converting a portion of that third floor into what became known as the Dark Tower, named after a Conte Cullen poem. the original concept was that it would be kind of a hangout for the young writers, and that it was an interesting business model where her friends who had money would pay, would help to create an endowment, and the young writers would go get subscriptions. Well, it kind of started out that way, but the young writers didn't quite live up to that, you know, getting those subscriptions, and the people who initially joined didn't continue their memberships. I know when people talk about WPFW, those that drive to get people to raise money and send money, they were sort of struggling.
Yeah, the lights and electricity have to be kept on.
And those things still need to be done.
Yeah.
But ultimately, it became this iconic space where the writers, the artists, the musicians, the actors, the business people, the white folks from downtown, the black folks from uptown, her international circle of friends.
Yes.
That's right. After she traveled overseas, when people she had met there, when they were coming to the U.S. or their friends were coming, they're like, you got to go to the Dark Tower. You have to go see Alelia Walker. So if or if somebody like Oscar DePriest, who was the black congressman from Chicago, was coming to Harlem, the Dark Tower or the Walker Studio was the place where you had to have your reception. People wanted to see just this taste of what Harlem, the glamour of Harlem was like, and they wanted to be there.
And it was a good counterpoint to some of the terrible generalizations and stereotypes that were going on in mainstream media at the time.
Yeah, you know, of course, we're all, you know, the white press has, during that period of time, the only time black people were in those papers usually was if somebody was murdered or somebody was accused of a crime. Our accomplishments were not included. Occasionally in some white newspapers, there would be a column called News of the Colored Folk. And so somebody would write, you know, what happened at the church or something like that. But for the most part, it was the black press that told our stories. And you know, we talk about the research. This book is so much richer because of the black press. Two of Alelia Walker's best friends were the society columnists for a number of black newspapers, Bessie Bearden and Geraldine Dismond, who later wrote the society column for Jet. They wrote about what happened there every week in their columns. And then there were the people I met in the early 80s when I was just starting my research, Alberta Hunter, and those kind of folks.
Yeah, we've neglected to mention some incredible people like the Robinsons and others that knew this family quite well. We have just a minute, not even that, I'm looking at a clock, but are there any last words? There's a sense of, that I detect a consciousness in what you wanted to do as a writer to your audience. Do you want to remark on how ideally you want the work to convey forward?
I want people to see Alelia Walker as a multidimensional person. They need to forget what they saw in Self-Made, the Netflix series, because that's not her. But it's also to see this black community where black folks are creating their own space, their culture, their businesses, and how we survive even in difficult times.
Well, thank you, Alelia Bundles. And again, we've been talking about the joy goddess, Alelia Walker. And it's just such a pleasure to have you here on We the People. Folks, that will about do it. I thank the News and Public Affairs Department of WPFW, our engineer, Mike Nasella. And I thank you, the listeners, for joining us and hopefully supporting us. Perhaps we'll meet again sometime in the future on the radio. Take good care.
The Can I Kick It outdoor summer movie series presented by Shaolin Jazz is back and is coming to Southeast DC for the first time ever. Enjoy 3 nights of martial arts and action films scored live with hip hop, soul, and more, mixed by WPFW alum DJ Two Tone Jones. Saturday, September 20th at Skyland Town Center with the screening of Berry Gordy's The Last Dragon. Then on Saturday, October 25th, the series concludes with the screening of I'm Gonna Get You Sucker at the Capitol Hill Boys Club Artist Gallery. Each event begins at 7 p.m. with a guest DJ set followed by the movie at 8:30 p.m. Blankets and lawn chairs are welcome. For more details, visit shaolinjazz.com. shaolinjazz.com.
Hi, this is Jim Byers, host of the Latin Flavor Classic Edition. Support from listeners like you are the tools that have built WPFW over nearly five decades. We provide news, music worth listening to, and in-depth conversations about your community and the world. One of the many ways that you could contribute is to donate a vehicle that you no longer need, running or not. It can do wonders for WPFW, so donate it for a tax break for 2024. Go to WPFWFM.org or call 1-866-WPFW-CAR. That's 1-866-973-9227 for more information. Help WPFW continue building a better world, one broadcast at a time.
The United Black Community presents the 21st annual Love Supreme, a musical, poetic birthday tribute to Netherroot, John Coltrane, featuring the Nasa Abaday Quintet, Cindy Brown, Kenny Carroll, Nana Malaya, and more on Friday, September 19, 2025 at 7 p.m. at E-Life Restaurant, 9033 Central Avenue, Capitol Heights, Maryland. Details, UBC and DC at yahoo.com, 240-832-7203. Thank you.
WPFW presents Genius plus Soul equals Ray and John. Tuesday, September 23rd, 5 a.m. until midnight. This will be a fundraising birthday tribute like no other, illuminating the lives and contributions of Ray Charles and John Coltrane, two icons of American music. Schedule and details at WPFWFM.org, where you can also contribute anytime. WPFW, preserving the culture, one broadcast at a time.
WPFW, your station for jazz and justice, is seeking a leader to serve as WPFW's next general manager. We are looking for someone with strong managerial skills, a commitment to independent media, an appreciation for African American culture and history, and a passion for community service. The general manager will guide WPFW's mission, oversee an extraordinary group of staff and volunteers, and help build the future of this listener-supported community treasure. If you are ready to lead with creativity, integrity, and vision, we want to hear from you. To apply or learn more, visit hr@pacifica.org.
What's it do if you're approached by the police?
We deserve to be safe in our neighborhoods.
Follow these tips to assert your rights.
If you're being stopped, detained, or arrested, the best thing to say is nothing.
Stick to only these questions. Am I free to go? If stopped by law enforcement, try to leave the conversation as quickly and safely as possible.
Ask, am I free to go?
If yes, walk away calmly and quietly. Running away could give them pretext to detain you. Officers may try an insider reaction. Ignore them. Knowing your rights is a great first step.
And asserting your rights is even better.
No social justice issue or movement can escape the spotlight of the Latino Media Collective. The Latino Media Collective delivers consequential coverage from the biggest countries.